In 1896, Fritz Hoffmann La Roche believed the industrial manufacture of medicines could play a major role in the fight against disease. And so he founded Roche. Today, Roche is the world's largest biotech organization and the number one investor in research and development to help people live longer, better lives. Roche's 90,000 employees in Ireland and around the world make a sustainable contribution to society through innovative medicines, diagnostics, personalized healthcare, and digital health. We are many, working as one. Roche, doing now what patients need next.
Hello, and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I am your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you.
Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Murphy. We are absolutely delighted to have you on. So thanks for giving us your time to talk about esophageal cancer today. If you don't mind, we might just start with the basics. And what exactly is esophageal cancer?
So esophageal cancer is, as the name suggests, cancer of the esophagus. So the esophagus is the medical term for the food pipe that connects your mouth to your stomach. And it's definitely rising in terms of the numbers in Ireland. So currently in Ireland, there are about 500 patients per year diagnosed with esophageal cancer.
Great. And what are some of the signs and symptoms that people should look out for?
So they're varied. So sometimes people will have reflux, which is where the contents of the stomach, which are acidic, come up from the stomach into the esophagus. And although that's very common in itself, but that's people may find that particular symptom gets worse or doesn't respond to treatments that they may have had before. And that's often a very, very early sign. And then as it progresses, it may cause problems swallowing or painful swallowing, particularly of solid foods. So meat is the classic thing that you hear people report that they've difficulty tolerating. And then as a result of that, people can lose weight unintentionally. So the important thing that if anybody has any persistent symptoms, so if their reflux was previously managed very well with antacids or proton pump inhibitors, such as omeprazole or things that you can get over the counter, and then they stop being managed or treated very well, then to go to your GP, who will then refer you then for investigations.
Brilliant. Thanks a million. And what are some of the risk factors that will be associated with esophageal cancer? And is there anything people can do to reduce them?
Yeah, so in common with many cancers, so the top two are smoking and heavy alcohol consumption. And then a third one is being overweight or having a high body mass index, that in itself. So all of those three things are modifiable. In very small numbers of cases, there are some hereditary conditions that people can predispose. It's very uncommon. They're far more common to have the other risk factors. And one of the major risk factors that we see is a thing called Barrett's esophagus. And Barrett's esophagus is really a precancerous condition that could take many years to develop. And one of the risk factors of Barrett's esophagus is having that reflux, having the acidic contents of the stomach going up and down into the esophagus. And essentially over time, it changes the lining of the esophagus. And that itself can predispose you to developing cancer. So if somebody has a Barrett's esophagus, there's a whole different pathway that they have to keep that under wraps and even to treat it. But Barrett's esophagus is heavily linked to, in most cases, to being overweight. So going back to smoking alcohol and being overweight. So there are two main types of esophageal cancer. One is called squamous cell cancer and the other is called adenocarcinoma. And in Ireland, the one that we see far more often is the adenocarcinoma one, which is the one that's connected to being overweight, whereas smoking and heavy alcohol consumption are much more likely to be associated with squamous cell cancers. And that's less than one third of all of our cases are squamous cell cancers.
And if you were to have Barrett's esophagus, like you were mentioning there, would you be attending for a regular screening?
Yeah, definitely. So Barrett's, like everything, is a spectrum. So you can have Barrett's esophagus where you just have the lining of the esophagus is changed to become more like what the stomach looks like. But that can progress all the way up to having precancerous cells, which is called dysplasia. And that in itself is a spectrum like everything else in medicine. So from low grade to high grade. So if you have the let's say the lowest grade of Barrett's esophagus, you would still have to have follow-up usually with a gastroenterologist. So oncologists, for example, we don't see patients with Barrett's esophagus because it's a precancerous condition. But you would have regular endoscopies every maybe 3 to 5 years. It depends, the guidelines change from country to country. Whereas if you had the other end of the spectrum, which would be a Barrett's esophagus with high-grade dysplasia, that would actually prompt the gastroenterologist to do treatment, specific treatment for that. So there's a whole range of endoscopic therapies that they can perform using the camera test, ranging from ablating or essentially destroying, taking off that layer of abnormal tissue, or resecting it as well, even in some cases. So the most important thing for both Barrett's esophagus with high-grade dysplasia and esophageal cancer is that they're all managed by multiple members of a team. So it takes more than one type of person to manage cancer or even Barrett's esophagus, ranging from the surgeon to the pathologist, the radiologist, and the different types of oncologists, the medical and radiation oncologist. So we have what are called MDMs, or multiple disciplinary meetings. And as the name suggests, you have everyone present from each of those disciplines, and they all give their input, and every patient benefits from that because they have everybody discussing their unique case and making a general recommendation about that. So for example, in Beaumont Hospital, the high-grade dysplasias from Barrett's will also be discussed at our MDM along with every patient who has esophageal cancer. So that's thankfully a really common feature of practice in Ireland. So it's been dictated by the National Cancer Control Program. So every hospital that performs or treats esophageal cancer, among other cancers, will have a designated MDM to discuss all of those cases individually.
Brilliant. I think that's really reassuring for patients to know as well that there's so many people involved in their care. If somebody does suspect esophageal cancer and they go to their GP, what would be the process of being diagnosed? What kind of tests might they have?
So the first thing they would usually do is refer somebody for what's called an OGD, which stands for esophagogastroduodenoscopy. And essentially that's a camera test where usually a gastroenterologist will look inside at the esophagus, because it's not something that you can see very well in a scan, unlike like say mammogram for breast cancers, for example. So the best way to diagnose esophageal cancer is for the gastroenterologist to do the procedure where they visualize directly what's inside the esophagus, and they go the whole way down through the stomach, even into the top part of the small intestine. And if they see a suspicious mass, they will then take a biopsy. And then that will go off to the lab and the pathologist will report that. And that's when you officially have your diagnosis of cancer, when they see cancer cells under the microscope.
And you did mention that there's two different types of esophageal cancer, so adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. Do you mind just briefly explaining the main differences between these two?
Yeah, so they essentially refer to what they look like under the microscope. So the pathologist will tell us whether it's a squamous cell cancer or an adenocarcinoma. So in general, squamous cell cancers tend to arise from the upper part of the esophagus, whereas an adenocarcinoma is the lower third to where the stomach is, because adenocarcinoma means gland forming. So that's what the stomach usually does. They're treated very similarly. They do differ, though, in what's called the staging. So whenever we present or discuss someone at an MDM, a multidisciplinary meeting, we discuss their stage. Well, that means the very objective classification system that we use called TNM. It stands for tumor node metastasis. And there's a TNM classification system for every cancer you can think of that's ever been described. And essentially, as the name suggests, it tells you the stage of the cancer as it goes through the esophagus, whether it's very superficial or whether it goes the whole way through the esophagus, ranges from 1 to 4. And then we have the nodes, tell us if there are lots of nodes or just a small number of nodes. And then metastasis means secondary cancer, where it's traveled from the esophagus to another part of the body. So squamous cell cancer and adenocarcinoma, to make this very confusing, actually have their own slightly different TNM staging, which I'm not going to bore you with. The squamous cell cancer takes the location into place where the adenocarcinoma doesn't, because most of them are in the very bottom of the esophagus. But in general, they're worked up the same. So when we use the word staging as oncologists, we are essentially trying to get that TNM designation correct for each person. And the reason why that's so important is because we literally build our treatment plan on that TNM stage. So you know, we mentioned that the GP will often refer somebody for an OGD or the camera test. That's really the first test that people will have to make the diagnosis. As soon as that's diagnosed, we're then usually into a CT scan. And then most cases will require a PET scan. And some cases will require, if they're sort of on the border between various stages, usually based on the MDM discussion and recommendation, they may also require an additional test called an EUS. And that stands for endoscopic ultrasound, which is, as the name suggests, is the camera test plus a little ultrasound probe on it. And that's really good for telling the T and the N stages. So not everyone requires an EUS, it's only a relatively small number. But if we're on the border to decide what the treatment plan is, and we think an EUS is going to make that more obvious or clarify that, then we'll use that to get additional information so as to pick the right treatment plan for an individual patient.
Brilliant. And you were speaking about staging there. In terms of esophageal cancer, do you mind just speaking a little bit about the staging? Thanks for mentioning the TNM. Actually, you're the first consultant who broke it down like that. Normally we go into 3-4, but it's interesting. Obviously, myself and Anne-Marie would be familiar with that term, but a lot of people probably wouldn't be. So thanks for that. But yeah, would you mind just discussing a little bit about the staging of esophageal cancer?
So the staging, every cancer, like I said, has its own unique staging. And thankfully, there are guidebooks that tell you what they are. And usually pathologists are really good at putting to the stage, because it gets really complex. And what we do is we break down each TNM into a category. So very generally speaking, among cancers, a stage one is a very early cancer, which is usually just gone maybe superficially through the organ. In the case of the esophagus, it hasn't gone very far into the muscle layers, because your esophagus is really a muscle tube. That's what with multiple layers of muscle. So it only gone through the very, very early, like the first muscle layer. It's often a stage one. And then a stage two may go further through that, or sometimes into one or so nearby lymph nodes. A stage three is where the cancer has spread into nearby lymph nodes, or sometimes gone the whole way through the full thickness of the esophagus. And then stage four is where it's spread to another part of your body. So that staging is important because it tells us what the next plan is going to be. So we have a very good plan for stage one versus two versus three versus four. But on top of that, we have to individualize it for every patient, because not every patient is the same. Some people have lots of pre-existing health conditions that you have to build into your treatment plan and make sure that sort of custom build it for each patient.
And then moving on, just touching off some of the treatment options available, what is an esophagectomy and what would be involved in this for a patient?
Yeah, so an esophagectomy is removal of a portion of the esophagus with the cancer. So when somebody comes through our MDM, one of the first questions that we ask is whether somebody has what's called a resectable cancer. And if they have a resectable cancer, can they go ahead and have that resection or esophagectomy straight away? Or do they need some pre-treatment or downstaging? These are all the sort of technical terms that we use. And these are based on really years of clinical trial evidence. We don't just pluck these ideas out of thin air. There were many, many clinical trials of patients with similar conditions. And we have good evidence of giving the pre-treatment improves outcomes, including increasing the cure of patients who have resectable esophageal cancer. So if we begin with the very earliest stage, a relatively small amount of patients with esophageal cancer have such an early stage that they can go straight to having surgery. And it often will, this is where the MDM conversation is really important, because that's where we hammer out the details. Does this person really have stage one or very, very early stage one? And if they do, then they would go and have the esophagectomy. More patients will need the pre-treatment beforehand. They will need a combination of chemotherapy or radiation, and with the goal of having downstaging the cancer, with the goal then of having surgery afterwards to remove them of the tumor. There are some people, of course, who would not tolerate such an aggressive treatment. And this is somebody is older with many multiple problems or many medical problems that were pre-existing, because we often say as oncologists that when you are diagnosed with cancer, your coexisting medical problems don't just go away. They all come to the table and they can interfere with your treatments, and we can't just ignore them. So for those people, there may be the option of doing what's called definitive chemoradiation, where we do a slightly longer course of radiation or slightly higher dose of radiation. And the goal is for that to be the treatment with not having surgery afterwards. And while I'm just on this point of staging, stage four, where the cancer has gone to other parts of the body, like the liver or lungs, for example, that's something that an esophagectomy is not offered, because you're just removing part of the problem. It's not worth going through all of the normal processes that you have to in terms of recovery that would follow an esophagectomy for that. So the goal would be more to control the cancer rather than cure it. But going back to your question about an esophagectomy. So like I said earlier, people may have had the esophagectomy upfront, or they may have it after a period of treatment. But for everybody who has an esophagectomy, there's definitely a period of recovery afterwards. Sometimes there are many different types of esophagectomy. I mentioned earlier that the esophagus often is divided into three thirds, so the upper, middle, and lower. So obviously a surgeon who's approaching an upper third esophagus would have to use a very different approach to the one that's for the lower third. So a lot of the services over the years, because of the National Cancer Treatment or National Cancer Program, have been centralized. So the upside of all of that is that esophagectomies in Ireland are only performed in certain institutions. And that's really good for patients, because they're then performed in centers which have all of the local expertise and skills. Because if you're going to be doing something like an esophagectomy, you need to be doing more than one a year or more than two a year to be good at them and for them to be safe doing them. And not only that, the rest of the multidisciplinary team, the nurses, the dietitians, all of the rest of the people who are part of really central to the patient's recovery are familiar with the usual trajectory. So after an esophagectomy, so a surgeon may put in a feeding tube straight into the small intestine during the surgery, or sometimes even at diagnosis, because your esophagus is, as the name suggests, it's a really important part of your digestive system. And it's only when it's not working do you realize how important it is. So people may have a lot of problems maintaining their weight if your swallowing is not working properly. So sometimes the tube is put in ahead of all of the treatment, or sometimes it's put in at the time of surgery. And people will often need that if they have it at the surgery before to 6 weeks afterwards. So a really important person in your care is going to be the dietitian. The dietitian will know all of the tricks to save you having to rediscover the wheel yourself, that they'll know which foods are high intense in calories and don't have empty calories. They'll be able to monitor your weight very closely. They're experts in that sort of artificial nutrition where you're fed into your stomach or your intestine, for example. And they are really a central part of the team in terms of getting people through their treatment and making sure that they are able to complete it.
That's great. Thanks a million. And thanks for setting that expectation. I think it's really good for people to know. You mentioned as well about some patients needing chemotherapy and radiation. What does that treatment look like for patients who need that?
So this is for patients who are have been determined at the MDM to need downstaging. So these are patients with, maybe they have some lymph nodes, or there's a certain, you know, part of the state. So usually most stages two and three and some stage ones require this preoperative treatment. So what that looks for the patient is that you would, the first thing you would do is go and meet your medical and radiation oncologists in clinic. I'm a medical oncologist, so I specialize in drugs for cancer, whereas a radiation oncologist, as the name suggests, is an expert in radiation. And they're very different mindsets and very different perspectives. So you need to see both to discuss that part of the treatment. So most patients will begin by having a planning scan, first of all, where they have what's called a simulation, which is where it feels like having a CT scan, except they sometimes have marks on you, including small tattoos sometimes, which are tiny little blue dots. And they'll be used to deliver the radiation very accurately during the treatment. And the way that we give the treatment is we combine radiation with drugs that will sensitize the cells to radiation. So radiation itself is given from a machine that doesn't touch you over a period of 5 to 6 weeks. It's given every day during the week, so Monday to Friday. It usually takes about 10 or 15 minutes a day. That's the sum total that it takes. We sort of joke that it often takes longer to find parking in your hospital to actually have the treatment. The chemotherapy is given once a week, so it's given intravenously. So you come to an oncology day ward. So as part of that process, you would usually meet a nurse specialist from the oncology department who will give you a lot of extra advice and very practical things about chemotherapy. And it's given intravenously, as I said, so an IV or cannula is put into your hand or arm. The chemotherapy is given along with anti-sickness medicine, and you go home afterwards. You don't stay overnight. And that's done once a week during the treatment. So you would end up getting 5 to 6 chemotherapy treatments during that course of chemo radiation.
That's really comprehensive. Thanks for explaining that so clearly. And I suppose we hear a lot of side effects and of these kind of treatments, but what are the main kind of side effects that patients and staff should be aware of when somebody is having radiation and chemotherapy combined?
Yeah, so there are always going to be, it's one of the first questions people often have in clinic is, you know, about the side effects. And there's often a huge amount of fear about them. So part of the process of coming to clinic is for your oncologist to judge whether they'll think you'll be able to get through your treatment, because we know from experience who will and who may need some modifications. So that's part of what oncologists do all the time is to figure that out. So, and one of the things that I always tell people is that you sort of have to make you sick to make you better. You know, there's no such thing as a cancer treatment that is devoid of side effects. It doesn't exist. We are giving you drugs or treatments that are designed to kill cells. So there are going to be some side effects. But in general, they're reversible. You're not going to feel like that forever. So the most common one that people will report is tiredness. And people will often say that they're very tired after the radiation or chemotherapy. But it is important to stay physically active as much as you can, not to wrap yourself up in cotton wool. From the radiation itself, some people may notice some redness in the area that the radiation is administered, or even maybe some worsening of their swallowing, or even some pain with that. Again, that's usually temporary. And you'll see a radiation oncology team member at least once a week or more frequently as needed, who'll be able to troubleshoot all of those problems with you and nip them in the bud sooner before they get out of hand. The chemotherapy can cause nausea. So we give everyone routinely anti-sickness medicine beforehand. Hair loss, this is a very common question. The drugs that we give do cause hair loss, I'm afraid to say. Again, it's temporary. And other things that we always have to keep an eye on are your blood counts. So we check them before every treatment, so once a week, because your blood counts can dip during chemotherapy. We just need to make sure, usually with the drugs that we give, which are called carboplatin and paclitaxel, they're given once a week, so they're quite low doses, along with the radiation, and just enough to sensitize the cells to the radiation. most people are able to get through that fine without needing major modifications from their blood count perspective.
That's great. And we also see more targeted therapies and also immunotherapies being used across different types of cancer. Are these kind of options available for people with esophageal cancer?
So it depends on your stage, to be honest. So most newer drugs, which targeted therapies and immunotherapy are newer compared to chemotherapy, they always begin in terms of their development with later stage. So currently they're indicated only for patients with stage 4 cancer. So patients where they have unresectable or metastatic cancer. So part of the workup that we do, when we do biopsies, we're able to add on certain molecular tests, including something called HER2. And the reason we do that is because if you have what's called a HER2 positive cancer, we have a treatment for that we can combine with chemotherapy. It's an antibody directed against HER2. There are other targeted therapies that are occasionally used for stage 4. Some of them are blood vessel blocking drugs. One of them is called ramucirumab. All of these drugs are like tongue twisters, unfortunately, for cancer. And there are a newer immunotherapy you mentioned as well. So that's, there have been some really promising studies about immunotherapy. So originally, immunotherapy was only given to patients with stage 4 cancer, which had already grown or become resistant to one type of chemotherapy. And they looked at the tumor and say, if you had one of the markers called PD-L1, if your tumor expressed a lot of that, that was the only type that responded. So alongside all of the trials are huge amounts of research being done to try and figure out why somebody does or doesn't respond to immunotherapy. So that for a long time was a cutoff that was used for esophageal and stomach cancers. But more recently, there have been some really exciting data from our huge international conference called ASCO, which is in the States, showing that if you combine chemotherapy with immunotherapy, that you can actually improve the responses and survival. So that's really exciting. And also, there have been a really exciting study that came out a few months ago based on an Irish oncologist, actually, who's based in the US, where you can give immunotherapy to patients who have had surgery but still have found some residual cancer left on their surgical specimen, and they did also much better with immunotherapy compared to the placebo. So that's a really exciting part of the field that's going to be coming our way. So how a lot of things end up being used in routine everyday practice, they go through a process. They have to be funded and considered by the various regulatory approval mechanisms, both in Europe and within Ireland. So just because it's been approved or released a month ago doesn't mean we can use it tomorrow. We have to wait a while before we can do that. But these are really exciting developments in the area of esophageal cancer.
That's fantastic. And is there anything we're missing that we haven't asked you that you'd like to include?
No, I think we've covered most things. I think the reality that most people with esophageal cancer, even if they've had surgery, will sometimes struggle with nutritional problems. So that's something that the dietitian and the nurse specialists with the surgical and oncology team are really, really pivotal to help people with those. And usually people, when they're beginning a treatment, which is part of multiple steps, it's very overwhelming. And you can just focus on one step at a time. That's what I tell people to do, that, you know, you are receiving this chemotherapy and radiation in preparation for surgery, but there are many steps to get there, and we'll meet you after each one of them and go through, update you and tell you. So for example, if you have been recommended to have chemotherapy and radiation ahead of an esophagectomy, you're not just going to finish your chemo radiation one day and turn up for your esophagectomy the next. There's going to be a period of recovery of about 4 weeks at least between then. You're going to have repeat scans, sometimes even a repeat OGD or endoscopy to look inside and check what the response has been. And again, you'll be discussed at the MDN to make sure that's still the right path for you. And then at the end, when you've had your surgery, the entire surgical specimen is discussed at the MDM to sort of correlate the response. So people should get a lot of a lot of comfort from knowing that the person, there are many people apart from the person that you're seeing in clinic who are considering your case and giving their expert opinion, because cancer management nowadays is much more than one person doing. We work very closely together as a team and we talk to each other all the time. So it's not that you're just getting one person's biases, you're getting a whole team of people's opinions. So just, you have to take it one step at a time and get your head around the next immediate steps, then stop, take stock. And it becomes very normal, as you guys know, working in an oncology day ward, it's amazing what you get used to. You suddenly, you've always been coming every week to an oncology day ward, whereas the very first time it's very overwhelming, and that's normal. Yeah. And then sometimes aside from that,
people actually not wanting to leave then toward the end.
Exactly. People are often more upset when they finish, because there are other supports as well. So depending where you get your cancer services, some people find that they get very anxious or very down, and a lot of that is normal. But if it's interfering with your treatment or your ability to tolerate the treatment, then there are other supports there, either through a lot of the drop-in cancer support services, or there's a whole specialty called psych-oncology, which is really a mixture of psychology and oncology, because people who have cancer have very different mental health needs than people who don't have cancer. So there's a whole specialty for people. So there are a lot of different supports out there aside from your oncology nurse and your oncologist who can help you get you through your treatment as best as possible.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much for your time. I think
you're welcome.
I think you've explained really, really well. And I think so many people are going to benefit from listening to you speak. So thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at @theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.